the landlord could not easily alter the terms. It was yet another encroachment on time-honoured traditions. Ralph did not want to make a further concession, but once again he had no option if he wanted to get the harvest in. And then he thought of a way he could use this situation to gain something else he wanted, and he cheered up. "All right," he said, "I'll give you a written lease. But I don't want men leaving the fields during the harvest. Your mother can come to Earl's Castle to collect the document next week." Gwenda walked to Earl's Castle on a baking hot day. She knew what Ralph wanted her for, and the prospect made her miserable. As she crossed the drawbridge into the castle, the rooks seemed to laugh derisively at her plight. The sun beat down mercilessly on the compound, where the walls blocked the breeze. The squires were playing a game outside the stables. Sam was among them, and too absorbed to notice Gwenda. They had tied a cat to a post at eye level, in such a way that it could move its head and legs. A squire had to kill the cat with his hands tied behind his back. Gwenda had seen the game before. The only way for the squire to achieve his object was to headbutt the wretched animal, but the cat naturally defended itself by scratching and biting the attacker's face. The challenger, a boy of about 16, was hovering near the post, watched by the terrified cat. Suddenly the boy jerked his head. His forehead smashed into the cat's chest, but the animal lashed out with its clawed paws. The squire yelped with pain and jumped back, his cheeks streaming blood, and all the other squires roared with laughter. Enraged, the challenger rushed at the post and butted the cat again. He was scratched worse, and he hurt his head, which they found even funnier. The third time he was more careful. Getting close, he fainted, making the cat lash out at thin air. Then he delivered a carefully aimed strike right at the beast's head. Blood poured from its mouth and nostrils, and it slumped, unconscious, though still breathing. He butted it a final time to kill it, and the others cheered and clapped. Gwenda felt sickened. She did not much like cats. She preferred dogs. But it was unpleasant to see any helpless creature tormented. She supposed that boys had to do this sort of thing to prepare them for maiming and killing human beings in war. Did it have to be that way? She moved on without speaking to her son. Perspiring, she crossed the second bridge and climbed the steps to the keep. The great hall was mercifully cool. She was glad Sam had not seen her. She was hoping to avoid him as long as possible. She did not want him to suspect that anything was wrong. He was not notably sensitive, but he might detect his mother's distress. She told the marshal of the hall why she was here, and he promised to let the Earl know. "Is Lady Philippa in residence?" Gwenda asked hopefully. Perhaps Ralph would be inhibited by the presence of his wife. But the marshal shook his head. "She's at Monmouth, with her daughter." Gwenda nodded grimly and settled down to wait. She could not help thinking about her encounter with Ralph at the hunting lodge. When she looked at the unadorned grey wall of the great hall, she saw him, staring at her as she undressed, his mouth slightly open in anticipation. As much as the intimacy of sex was a joy with the man she loved, so much was it loathsome with one she hated. The first time Ralph had coerced her, more than 20 years ago, her body had betrayed her, and she had felt a physical pleasure, even while experiencing a spiritual revulsion. The same thing had happened with Alwyn the outlaw in the forest, but it had not occurred this time with Ralph in the hunting lodge. She attributed the change to age. When she had been a young girl, full of desire, the physical act had triggered an automatic response, something she could not help, although it had made her even more ashamed. Now, in her maturity, her body was not so vulnerable, the reflex not so ready. She could at least be grateful for that. The stairs at the far end of the hall led to the Earl's chamber. Men were going up and down constantly, knights, servants, tenants, bailiffs. After an hour, the marshal told her to go up. She was afraid Ralph would want sex there and then, but she was relieved to find that he was having a business day. With him were Sir Alan and two priest clerks, sitting at a table with writing materials. One of the clerks handed her a small vellum scroll. She did not look at it. She could not read. "There," said Ralph, "now your son is a free tenant. Isn't that what you always wanted?" She had wanted freedom for herself, as Ralph knew. She had never achieved it. But Ralph was right. Davy had. That meant that her life had not been completely without purpose. Her grandchildren would be free and independent, growing what crops they chose, paying their rent and keeping for themselves everything else they earned. They would never know the miserable existence of poverty and hunger that Gwenda had been born to. Was that worth all she had been through? She did not know. She took the scroll and went to the door. Alan came after her and spoke in a low voice as she was going out. "Stay here tonight in the hall," he said. The great hall was where most of the castle's residents slept. "Tomorrow, be at the hunting lodge 2 hours after midday." She tried to leave without replying. Alan barred her way with his arm. "Understand?" he said. "Yes," she said in a low voice. "I will be there in the afternoon." He let her go. She did not speak to Sam until late in the evening. The squire spent the whole afternoon at various violent games. She was glad to have the time to herself. She sat in the cool hall alone with her thoughts. She tried to tell herself that it was nothing for her to have sexual congress with Ralph. She was no virgin, after all. She had been married for 20 years. She had had sex thousands of times. It would all be over in a few minutes, and it would leave no scars. She would do it and forget it. Until the next time. That was the worst of it. He could go on coercing her indefinitely. His threat to reveal the secret of Sam's paternity would terrify her as long as Wulfric was alive. Surely Ralph would tire of her soon and go back to the firm young bodies of his tavern wenches. "What's the matter with you?" Sam said when at dusk the squires came in for supper. "Nothing," she said quickly. "Davy's bought me a milking cow." Sam looked a bit envious. He was enjoying life, but squires were not paid. They had little need of money. They were provided with food, drink, accommodation, and clothing. But all the same, a young man liked to have a few pennies in his wallet. They talked about Davy's forthcoming wedding. "You and Annet are going to be grandmothers together," Sam said. "You'll have to make your peace with her." "Don't be stupid," Gwenda snapped. "You don't know what you're talking about." Ralph and Alan emerged from the chamber when supper was served. All the residents and visitors assembled in the hall. The kitchen staff brought in 3 large pike baked with herbs. Gwenda sat near the foot of the table, well away from Ralph, and he took no notice of her. After dinner, she lay down to sleep in the straw on the floor beside Sam. It was a comfort to her to lie next to him, as she had when he was little. She remembered listening to his childish breathing, soft and contented, in the silence of the night. Drifting off, she thought about how children grew up to defy their parents' expectations. Her own father had wanted to treat her like a commodity to be traded, but she had angrily refused to be used that way. Now each of her sons was taking his own road through life, and in both cases it was not the one she had planned. Sam would be a knight, and Davy was going to marry Annette's daughter. "If we knew how they would turn out," she thought, "would we be so eager to have them?" She dreamed that she went to Ralph's hunting lodge and found that he was not there, but there was a cat on his bed. She knew she had to kill the cat, but she had her hands tied behind her back, so she butted it with her head until it died. When she woke up, she wondered if she could kill Ralph at the lodge. No one knew she was going to meet him there. If she killed him and simply walked on home, she would not even be suspected. No one knew of her motive. It was a secret. That was the whole point. Someone might realize she had been near the lodge at the time, but they would only ask her whether she had seen any suspicious-looking men in the vicinity. It would not occur to them that big, strong Ralph might have been murdered by a small, middle-aged woman. But could she do it? She had killed Alwyn all those years ago, sticking his own knife into his throat and pushing it up into his head until its point had come out through his eye. She had killed Sim Chapman, too, holding his head under the water while he wriggled and thrashed, keeping him there until he breathed the river into his lungs and died. If Ralph went to the hunting lodge alone, she might be able to kill him, if she chose her moment well. But he would not be on his own. Earls never went anywhere alone. He would have Alan with him, as he had before. It was unusual for him to travel with only one companion. It was unlikely he would have none. Could she kill them both? She thought about it, but she knew in her heart it was hopeless. They were experienced men of violence. They had been at war, off and on, for 20 years, most recently in the campaign of the winter before last. They had quick reflexes, and their reactions were deadly. Many French knights had wanted to kill them, and had died trying. She might have killed one, using guile and surprise, but not two. She was going to have to submit to Ralph. Grimly, she went outside and washed her face and hands. When she came back into the great hall, the kitchen staff were putting out rye bread and weak ale for breakfast. Sam was dipping the stale bread into his ale to soften it. "You've got that look again," he said. "What's the matter?"
"Nothing," she said. She drew her knife and cut a slab of the bread. "I've got a long walk ahead of me."
"Is that what you're worried about? You shouldn't really go on your own. Most women don't like to travel alone."
"I'm tougher than most women." She was pleased that he showed concern for her. It was something his real father, Ralph, would never have done. Wulfric had had some influence over the boy after all, but she was embarrassed that he had read her expression and divined her state of mind.
"You don't need to worry about me."
"I could come with you," he offered. "I'm sure the Earl would let me. He doesn't need any squires today. He's going off somewhere with Alan Fernhill." That was the last thing she wanted. If she failed to keep her rendezvous, Ralph would let out the secret. She could readily imagine the pleasure Ralph would take in that. He would not need much provocation.
"No," she said firmly. "Stay here. You never know when your Earl will call for you."
"He won't call for me. I should come with you. I absolutely forbid it."
Gwenda swallowed a mouthful of her bread and stuffed the rest into her wallet.
"You're a good boy to worry about me, but it's not necessary."
She kissed his cheek.
"Take care of yourself. Don't run unnecessary risks. If you want to do something for me, stay alive."
She walked away. At the door, she turned. He was watching her thoughtfully. She forced herself to give what she hoped was a carefree smile. Then she went out. On the road, Gwenda began to worry that someone might find out about her liaison with Ralph. Such things had a way of getting out. She had met him once, she was about to do so a second time, and she feared there might be more such occasions. How long would it be before someone saw her leaving the road and heading into the woods at a certain point in her journey, and wondered why? What if someone should stumble by accident into the hunting lodge at the wrong moment? How many people would notice that Ralph went off with Alan whenever Gwenda was travelling from Earl's Castle to Wigley? She stopped at a tavern just before noon and had some ale and cheese. Travellers generally left such places in a group for safety, but she made sure to wait behind so that she would be alone on the road. When she came to the point where she had to turn into the woods, she looked ahead and behind to make sure there was no one watching. She thought she saw a movement in the trees a quarter of a mile back, and she peered into the hazy distance, trying to make out more clearly what she had seen. But no one was there. She was just getting jumpy. She thought again about killing Ralph as she waded through the summer undergrowth. If by some lucky chance Alan was not here, might she find an opportunity? But Alan was the one person in the world who knew she was meeting Ralph here. If Ralph were killed, Alan would know who had done it. she would have to kill him too, and that seemed impossible. There were two horses outside the lodge. Ralph and Alan were inside, sitting at the little table, with the remains of a meal in front of them. Half a loaf, a ham bone, the rind of a cheese, and a wine flask. Gwenda closed the door behind her. "Here she is, as promised," Alan said with a satisfied air. Clearly he had been given the job of getting her to come to the rendezvous, and he was relieved she had obeyed orders. "Just perfect for your dessert," he said, "like a raisin, wrinkled but sweet." Gwenda said to Ralph, "Why don't you get him out of here?" Alan stood up. "Always the insolent remark," he said. "Will you never learn?" But he left the room, going into the kitchen and slamming the door behind him. Ralph smiled at her. "Come here," he said. She moved obediently closer to him. "I'll tell Alan not to be so rude, if you like." "Please don't," she said, horrified. "If he starts being nice to me, people will wonder why."
"As you please."
He took her hand and tried to draw her closer. "Sit on my lap. Couldn't we just fuck and get it over with?" He laughed.
"That's what I like about you. You're honest."
He stood up, held her shoulders, and looked into her eyes. Then he bent his head and kissed her. It was the first time he had done this. They had had sex twice without ever kissing. Now Gwenda was revolted. As his lips pressed against hers, she felt more violated than when he had thrust his penis into her. He opened his mouth, and she tasted his cheesy breath. She pulled away, disgusted.
"No,"
she said.
"Remember what you stand to lose."
"Please don't do this." He started to become angry.
"I will have you," he said loudly. "Get that dress off."
"Please, let me go," she said.
He started to say something, but she raised her voice to speak over him. The walls were thin, and she knew that Alan in the kitchen could hear her pleading, but she did not care.
"Don't force me, I beg you."
"I don't care what you say," he shouted. "Get on that bed.
Please don't make me."
The front door flew open. Both Gwenda and Ralph turned and stared. Sam stood there. Gwenda said,
"Oh, God, no."
The three of them were frozen still for a split second, and in that moment, Gwenda guessed all at once what had happened. Sam had been worried about her, and, disobeying her orders, he had followed her from Earl's Castle, staying out of sight but never far behind. He had seen her leave the road and head into the woods. She had caught a flash of movement when she looked behind, but she had dismissed it. He had found the hut, arriving a minute or two after her. He must have stood outside and heard the shouting. It must have been obvious that Ralph was in the process of forcing Gwenda to submit to unwanted sex, although, recalling in a flash what they had said, Gwenda realized they had not mentioned the true reason she had to submit. The secret had not been revealed, yet. Sam drew his sword. Ralph leaped to his feet. As Sam rushed at him, Ralph managed to get his own sword out. Sam swung at Ralph's head, but Ralph raised his sword just in time to parry the stroke. Gwenda's son was trying to kill his father. Sam was in terrible danger. Hardly more than a boy, he was up against a battle-hardened soldier. Ralph shouted,
"Alan!"
Then Gwenda realized Sam was up against not one, but two veterans. She dashed across the room. As the kitchen door came open, she stood on the far side of the doorway and flattened herself against the wall. She drew the long dagger from her belt. The door flew wide, and Alan stepped into the room. He looked at the two fighters and did not see Gwenda. He paused for an instant, taking in the scene in front of him. Sam's sword swept through the air again, aimed at Ralph's neck, and again Ralph took the blow on his own sword. Alan could see instantly that his master was under furious attack. His hand went to the hilt of his sword, and he took a pace forward. Then Gwenda stabbed him in the back. She thrust the long dagger in and upwards as hard as she could, pushing with a field worker's strength, thrusting through the muscles of Alan's back, up through kidneys and stomach and lungs, hoping to reach his heart. The knife was 10 inches long, pointed and sharp, and it sliced through his organs. But it did not kill him immediately. He roared with pain, then suddenly went silent. Staggering, he turned and grabbed her, pulling her to him in a wrestler's embrace. She stabbed him again, in the stomach this time, with the same upward stroke through the vital organs. Blood came out of his mouth. He went limp, and his arms fell to his sides. He stared for a moment with a look of utter incredulity at the contemptible little woman who had ended his life. Then his eyes closed, and he fell to the floor. Gwenda looked at the other two. Sam struck, and Ralph parried. Ralph stepped back, and Sam advanced. Sam struck again, and Ralph parried again. Ralph was defending himself vigorously, but not attacking. Ralph was fearful of killing his son. Sam, not knowing that his opponent was his father, had no such scruples, and pressed forward, slashing with his sword. Gwenda knew this could not go on for long. One of them would hurt the other, and then it would become a fight to the death. Holding her bloody knife ready, she looked desperately for a chance to intervene and stab Ralph the way she had stabbed Alan. "Wait," Ralph said, holding up his left hand, but Sam was angry and thrust at him regardless. Ralph parried and spoke again. "Wait!" He was gasping from exertion, but he managed to get a few words out. "There's something you don't know." "I know enough," Sam yelled, and Gwenda could hear the note of boyish hysteria in his big man's voice. He swung again. "You don't," Ralph shouted. Gwenda knew that Ralph wanted to tell Sam. He was going to say, "I am your father." It must not happen. "Listen to me," Ralph said, and at last Sam responded. He stepped back, though he did not lower his sword. Ralph panted, catching his breath in preparation for speaking, and, as he paused, Gwenda ran at him. He spun around to face her, at the same time swinging his sword to the right in a flat arc. His blade hit hers, knocking the knife out of her hand. She was completely defenseless, and she knew that if he slashed at her with the return stroke, she would be killed. But, for the first time since Sam had drawn his sword, Ralph's guard was open, leaving the front of his body undefended. Sam stepped forward and thrust his sword into Ralph's chest. The pointed tip of the blade passed through Ralph's light summer tunic and entered his body on the left side of his breastbone. It must have slipped between two ribs, for the blade sank farther in. Sam gave a bloodthirsty cry of triumph and pushed harder. Ralph staggered backwards under the impact. His shoulders hit the wall behind him, but still Sam came forward, pushing with all his might. The sword seemed to pass all the way through Ralph's chest. There was a strange thud as the point came out of his back and stuck into the timber of the wall. Ralph's eyes looked into Sam's face, and Gwenda knew what he was thinking. Ralph understood that he had been wounded fatally, and, in the last few seconds of his life, he knew that he had been killed by his own son. Sam let go of the sword, but it did not fall. It was embedded in the wall, impaling Ralph gruesomely. Sam stepped back, aghast. Ralph was not yet dead. His arms waved feebly in an effort to grab the sword and pull it out of his chest, but he was not able to coordinate his movements. Gwenda realized in a ghastly flash that he looked a bit like the cat the squires had tied to the post. She stooped and quickly picked up her dagger from the floor. Then, incredibly, Ralph spoke.
"Sam," he said, "I am..."
Then blood spurted from his mouth in a sudden flood, cutting off his speech. Thank God, Gwenda thought. The torrent stopped as quickly as it had started, and he spoke again.
I am...
This time he was stopped by Gwenda. She leaped forward and thrust her dagger into his mouth. He made a gruesome choking noise. The blade sank into his throat. She let go of the knife and stepped back. She stared in horror at what she had done. The man who had tormented her for so long was nailed to the wall as if crucified, with a sword through his chest and a knife in his mouth. He made no sound, but his eyes showed that he was alive, as they looked from Gwenda to Sam and back again, in agony and terror and despair. They stood still, staring at him, silent, waiting. At last, his eyes closed. Chapter 91. The plague faded away in September. Caris's hospital gradually emptied, as patients died without being replaced by new ones. The vacant rooms were swept and scrubbed, and juniper logs were burned in the fireplaces, filling the hospital with a sharp autumn fragrance. Early in October, the last victim was laid to rest in the hospital's graveyard. A smoky red sun rose over Kingsbridge Cathedral as four strong young nuns lowered the shrouded corpse into the hole in the ground. The body was that of a crook-backed weaver from Outhenby, but, as Caris gazed into the grave, she saw her old enemy, the plague, lying on the cold earth. Under her breath, she said, "Are you really dead? Or will you come back again?" When the nuns returned to the hospital after the funeral, there was nothing to do. Caris washed her face, brushed her hair, and put on the new dress she had been saving for this day. It was the bright red of Kingsbridge scarlet. Then she walked out of the hospital for the first time in half a year. She went immediately into Merthin's garden. His pear trees cast long shadows in the morning sun. The leaves were beginning to redden and crisp, while a few late fruits still hung on the boughs, round-bellied and brown. Arne, the gardener, was chopping firewood with an axe. When he saw Caris, he was at first startled and frightened. Then he realized what her appearance meant, and his face split in a grin. He dropped his axe and ran into the house. In the kitchen, Em was boiling porridge over a cheerful fire. She looked at Caris as at a heavenly apparition. She was so moved that she kissed Caris's hands. Caris went up the stairs and into Merthin's bedroom. He was standing at the window in his undershirt, looking out at the river that flowed past the front of the house. He turned towards her, and her heart faltered to see his familiar, irregular face, the gaze of alert intelligence and the quick humor in the twist of his lips. His golden brown eyes looked loving at her, and his mouth widened in a welcoming smile. He showed no surprise. He must have noticed that there had been fewer and fewer patients arriving at the hospital, and he would have been expecting her to reappear any day. He looked like a man whose hopes have been fulfilled. She stood beside him at the window. He put his arm around her shoulders, and she put hers around his waist. There was a little more grey in his red beard than 6 months ago, she thought, and his halo of hair seemed to have receded a little farther, unless it was her imagination. For a moment, they both looked out at the river. In the grey morning light, the water was the colour of iron. The surface shifted endlessly, mirror bright or deep black in irregular patterns, always changing and always the same.
"It's over,"
Caris said. Then they kissed. Merthin announced a special autumn fair to celebrate the reopening of the town. It was held during the last week of October. The wool dealing season was over, but anyway, fleeces were no longer the principal commodity traded in Kingsbridge, and thousands of people came to buy the scarlet cloth for which the town was now famous. At the Saturday night banquet that opened the fair, the guild honored Caris. Although Kingsbridge had not totally escaped the plague, it had suffered much less than other cities, and most people felt they owed their lives to her precautions. She was everyone's hero. The guildsmen insisted on marking her achievement, and Madge Webber devised a new ceremony in which Caris was presented with a gold key, symbolizing the key to the city gate. Merthyn felt very proud. Next day, Sunday, Merthyn and Caris went to the cathedral. The monks were still at St. John in the Forest, so the service was taken by Father Michael from St. Peter's Parish Church in the town. Lady Philippa, Countess of Shiring, showed up. Merthyn had not seen Philippa since Ralph's funeral. Not many tears had been shed for his brother, her husband. The Earl would normally have been buried at Kingsbridge Cathedral, but because the town had been closed, Ralph had been interred in Shiring. His death remained a mystery. His body had been found in a hunting lodge, stabbed through the chest. Alan Fernhill lay on the floor nearby, also dead of stab wounds. The two men appeared to have had dinner together, for the remains of a meal were still on the table. Obviously there had been a fight, but it was not clear whether Ralph and Alan had inflicted fatal wounds on one another, or someone else had been involved. Nothing had been stolen. Money was found on both bodies, their costly weapons lay beside them, and two valuable horses were cropping the grass in the clearing outside. Because of that, the Shiring coroner inclined to the theory that the two men had killed one another. In another sense, there was no mystery. Ralph had been a man of violence, and it was no surprise that he had died a violent death. "They that live by the sword shall die by the sword," Jesus said, although that verse was not often quoted by the priests of King Edward III's reign. If anything was remarkable, it was that Ralph had survived so many military campaigns, so many bloody battles, and so many charges by the French cavalry, to die in a squabble a few miles from his home. Merthyn had surprised himself by weeping at the funeral. He wondered what he was sad about. His brother had been a wicked man who caused a great deal of misery, and his death was a blessing. Merthyn had not been close to him since he murdered Tilly. What was there to mourn? In the end, Merthyn decided he was grieving for a Ralph that might have been, a man whose violence was not indulged but controlled, whose aggression was directed not by ambition for personal glory, but by a sense of justice. Perhaps it had once been possible for Ralph to grow into such a man. When the two of them had played together, aged 5 and 6, floating wooden boats on a muddy puddle, Ralph had not been cruel and vengeful. That was why Merthyn cried. Philippa's two boys had been at the funeral, and they were with her today. The elder, Jerry, was Ralph's son by poor Tilly. The younger, Rowley, was believed by everyone to be Ralph's son by Philippa, though in fact he was Merthyn's. Fortunately, Rowley was not a small, lively redhead like Merthyn. He was going to be tall and dignified like his mother. Rowley was clutching a small wooden carving, which he presented solemnly to Merthyn. It was a horse, and he had done it rather well for a 10-year-old, Merthyn realized. Most children would have sculpted the animal standing firmly on all 4 feet, but Rowley had made it move, its legs in different positions and its mane flying in the wind. The boy had inherited his real father's ability to visualize complex objects in 3 dimensions. Merthyn felt an unexpected lump in his throat. He bent down and kissed Rowley's forehead. He gave Philippa a grateful smile. He guessed she had encouraged Rowley to give him the horse, knowing what it would mean to him. He glanced at Caris and saw that she, too, understood its significance, though nothing was said. The atmosphere in the great church was joyful. Father Michael was not a charismatic preacher, and he went through the Mass in a mumble. But the nuns sang as beautifully as ever, and an optimistic sun shone through the rich, dark colors of the stained glass windows. Afterwards they walked around the fair in the crisp autumn air. Caris held Merthyn's arm, and Philippa walked on his other side. The two boys ran on ahead, while Philippa's bodyguard and lady-in-waiting followed behind. Business was good, Merthyn saw. Kingsbridge craftsmen and traders were already beginning to rebuild their fortunes. The town would recover from this epidemic faster than from the last. senior members of the guild were going around checking weights and measures. There were standards for the weight of a woolsack, the width of a piece of cloth, the size of a bushel, and so on, so that people knew what they were buying. Merthyn encouraged guildsmen to perform these checks ostentatiously, so that buyers could see how carefully the town monitored its tradesmen. Of course, if they really suspected someone of cheating, they would check discreetly and then, if he was guilty, get rid of him quietly. Philippa's two sons ran excitedly from one stall to the next. Watching Rowley, Merthyn said quietly to Philippa, "Now that Ralph has gone, is there any reason why Rowley should not know the truth?" She looked thoughtful. "I wish I could tell him. But would it be for his sake or ours? For 10 years he's believed Ralph to be his father. 2 months ago he wept at Ralph's graveside. It would be a terrible shock to tell him now that he is another man's son." They were speaking in low voices, but Caris could hear, and she said, "I agree with Philippa. You have to think of the child, not of yourself." Merthyn saw the sense of what they were saying. It was a small sadness on a happy day. "There is another reason," Philippa said. "Gregory Longfellow came to me last week. The king wants to make Jerry Earl of Shiring." "At the age of 13, Merthyn said. "The title of Earl is always hereditary, once it has been granted, although baronies are not. Anyway, I would administer the earldom for the next 3 years. As you did all the time Ralph was away fighting the French. You'll be relieved the king isn't asking you to marry again." She made a face. "I'm too old." "So Rowley will be second in line for the earldom, provided we keep our secret. If something should happen to Jerry," Merthyn thought, "my son will become Earl of Shiring. Fancy that." "Rowley would be a good ruler," Philippa said. "He's intelligent and quite strong-willed, but not cruel, like Ralph." Ralph's mean nature had been obvious at an early age. He had been 10, Rowley's age now, when he shot Gwenda's dog. But Rowley might prefer to be something else. He looked again at the carved wooden horse. Philippa smiled. She did not smile often, but when she did, it was dazzling. She was still beautiful, he thought. She said, "Give in to it, and be proud of him." Merthyn recalled how proud his father had been when Ralph became the Earl, but he knew he would never feel the same way. He would be proud of Rowley, whatever he did, as long as he did it well. Perhaps the boy would become a stonemason and carve saints and angels. Perhaps he would be a wise and merciful nobleman. Or he might do something else, something his parents had never anticipated. Merthyn invited Philippa and the boys to dinner, and they all left the cathedral precincts. They walked over the bridge against the flow of loaded carts coming to the fair. They crossed Leper Island together and went through the orchard into the house. In the kitchen, they found Lola. As soon as she saw her father, she burst into tears. He put his arms around her and she sobbed on his shoulder. Wherever she had been, she must have got out of the habit of washing, for she smelled like a pigsty, but he was too happy to care. It was a while before they could get any sense out of her. When at last she spoke, she said, "They all died." Then she burst into fresh tears. After a while she calmed down and spoke more coherently. "They all died," she repeated, suppressing her sobs. "Jake and Boyo, Nettie and Hal, Joni and Chalky and Ferret, one by one, and nothing I did made any difference." They had been living in the forest, Merthyn gathered, a group of youngsters pretending to be nymphs and shepherds. The details came out gradually. The boys would kill a deer every now and again, and sometimes they would go away for a day and come back with a barrel of wine and some bread. Lola said they bought their supplies, but Merthyn guessed they had robbed travellers. Lola had somehow imagined they could live like that forever. She had not thought about how things might be different in the winter. But in the end, it was the plague rather than the weather that brought the idyll to an end. "I was so frightened," Lola said.
I wanted Karis.
Jerry and Rolly listened with mouths agape. They idolized their older cousin Lola. Although she had come home in tears, the story of her adventure only enhanced her in their eyes.
I never want to feel like that again, Lola said, so powerless, with my friends all sick and dying around me.
I can understand that, Karis said. It's how I felt when my mother died.
Will you teach me to heal people?
Lola said to her.
I want to really help them, as you do, not just sing hymns and show them a picture of an angel. I want to understand about bones and blood, and herbs and things that make people better. I want to be able to do something when a person is sick.
Of course I'll teach you. If that's what you want, Karis said, I would be pleased. Merthyn was astonished. Lola had been rebellious and bad-tempered for some years now, and part of her rejection of authority had been a pretense that Karis, her stepmother, was not really her parent and need not be respected. He was delighted by the turnaround. It was almost worth the agony of worry he had been through. A moment later, a nun came into the kitchen.
Little Annie Jones is having a fit, and we don't know why, she said to Karis. Can you come?
Of course, Karis said.
Lola said, Can I go with you?
No, said Karis. Here's your first lesson. You have to be clean. Go and wash now. You can come with me tomorrow. As she was leaving, Madge Webber came in.
Have you heard the news? She said, her face grim. Philemon is back.
On that Sunday, Davy and Amabel were married at the little church in Wigley. Lady Philippa gave permission for the manor house to be used for the party. Wulfric killed a pig and roasted it whole over a fire in the yard. Davy had bought sweet currants, and Annet baked them in buns. There was no ale. Much of the barley harvest had rotted in the fields for want of reapers, but Philippa had sent Sam home with a present of a barrel of cider. Gwenda still thought, every day, about that scene in the hunting lodge. In the middle of the night she stared into the darkness and saw Ralph with her knife in his mouth, the hilt sticking out between his brown teeth, and Sam's sword nailing him to the wall. When she and Sam had retrieved their weapons, pulling them grimly out of Ralph, and the corpse had fallen to the floor, it had looked as if the two dead men had killed one another. Gwenda had smeared blood on their unstained weapons and left them where they lay. Outside, she had loosened the horses' tethers so that they could survive for a few days, if necessary, until someone found them. Then she and Sam had walked away. The Shiring coroner had speculated that outlaws might have been involved in the deaths, but in the end had come to the conclusion Gwenda expected. No suspicion had fallen on her or Sam. They had got away with murder. She had told Sam an edited version of what had happened between her and Ralph. She pretended that this was the first time he had tried to coerce her, and she said he had simply threatened to kill her if she refused. Sam was awestruck to think that he had killed an earl, but he had no doubt that his action had been justified. He had the right temperament for a soldier, Gwenda realized. He would never suffer agonies of remorse over killing. Nor did she, even though she often recalled the scene with revulsion. She had killed Alan Fernhill and finished Ralph off, but she had not a twinge of regret. The world was a better place without both of them. Ralph had died in the agony of knowing that his own son had stabbed him through the heart, and that was exactly what he deserved. In time, she felt sure, the vision of what she had done would cease to come to her by night. She put the memory out of her mind and looked around the hall of the manor house at the carousing villagers. The pig was eaten, and the men were drinking the last of the cider. Aaron Appletree produced his bagpipes. The village had had no drummer since the death of Annette's father, Perkin. Gwenda wondered whether Davy would take up drumming now. Wulfric wanted to dance, as he always did when he had had a bellyful of drink. Gwenda partnered him for the first number, laughing as she tried to keep up with his cavorting. He lifted her, swung her through the air, crushed her to his body, and put her down again, only to circle her with great leaps. He had no sense of rhythm, but his sheer enthusiasm was infectious. Afterwards, she declared herself exhausted, and he danced with his new daughter-in-law, Amabel. Then, of course, he danced with Annette. His eye fell on her as soon as the tune ended, and he let go of Amabel. Annette was sitting on a bench at one side of the hall of the manor house. She wore a green dress that was girlishly short and showed her dainty ankles. The dress was not new, but she had embroidered the bosom with yellow and pink flowers. As always, a few ringlets had escaped from her headdress, and they hung around her face. She was 20 years too old to dress that way, but she did not know it, and nor did Wulfric. Gwenda smiled as they began to dance. She wanted to look happy and carefree, but she realized her expression might be more like a grimace, and she gave up trying. She tore her gaze away from them and watched Davy and Amabel. Perhaps Amabel would not turn out quite like her mother. She had some of Annette's coquettish ways, but Gwenda had never seen her actually flirting, and right now she seemed uninterested in anyone but her husband. Gwenda scanned the room and located her other son, Sam. He was with the young men, telling a story, miming it, holding the reins of an imaginary horse and almost falling off. He had them spellbound. They probably envied his luck in becoming a squire. Sam was still living at Earl's Castle. Lady Philippa had kept on most of the squires and men-at-arms, for her son Jerry would need them to ride and hunt with him, and practice with the sword and the lance. Gwenda hoped that during the period of Philippa's regency, Sam would learn a more intelligent and merciful code than he would have got from Ralph. There was not much else to look at, and Gwenda's gaze returned to her husband and the woman he had once wanted to marry. As Gwenda had feared, Annette was making the most of Wulfric's exuberance and inebriation. She gave him sexy smiles when they danced apart, and when they came together she clung to him, Gwenda thought, like a wet shirt. The dance seemed to go on forever, Aaron Appletree repeating the bouncy melody endlessly on his bagpipes. Gwenda knew her husband's moods, and now she saw the glint in his eye that always appeared when he was about to ask her to lie with him. Annette knew exactly what she was doing, Gwenda thought furiously. She shifted restlessly on her bench, willing the music to stop, trying not to let her anger show. However, she was seething with indignation when the tune ended with a flourish. She made up her mind to get Wulfric to calm down and sit beside her. She would keep him close for the rest of the afternoon, and there would be no trouble. But then Annette kissed him. While he still had his hands on her waist, she stood on tiptoe and tilted her face and kissed him full on the lips, briefly but firmly, and Gwenda boiled over. She jumped up from her bench and strode across the hall. As she passed the bridal couple, her son Davy saw the expression on her face and tried to detain her, but she ignored him. She went up to Wulfric and Annette, who were still gazing at one another and smiling stupidly. She poked Annette's shoulder with her finger and said loudly, "Leave my husband alone." Wulfric said, "Gwenda, please, don't you say anything." Gwenda said, "Just stay away from this whore." Annette's eyes flashed defiance. "It's not dancing that whores are paid for. I'm sure you know all about what whores do. How dare you?" Davy and Amabel intervened. Amabel said to Annette, "Please, don't make a scene, Ma." Annette said, "It's not me, it's Gwenda." Gwenda said, "I'm not the one trying to seduce someone else's husband." Davy said, "Mother, you're spoiling the wedding." Gwenda was too enraged to listen. "She always does this. She jilted him 23 years ago, but she's never let him go." Annette began to cry. Gwenda was not surprised. Annette's tears were just another means of getting her way. Wulfric reached out to pat Annette's shoulder, and Gwenda snapped, "Don't touch her!" He jerked back his hand as if burned. "You don't understand," Annette sobbed. "I understand you all too well."
Gwenda said. No, you don't, Annette said. She wiped her eyes and gave Gwenda a surprisingly direct, candid look. You don't understand that you have won. He's yours. You don't know how he adores you, respects you, admires you. You don't see the way he looks at you when you're speaking to someone else.
Gwenda was taken aback. Well, she mumbled, but she did not know what else to say.
Annette went on. Does he eye younger women? Does he ever sneak away from you? How many nights have you slept apart in the last 20 years? 2? 3? Can't you see that he will never love another woman as long as he lives?
Gwenda looked at Wulfric and realized that all this was true. In fact, it was obvious. She knew it, and so did everyone. She tried to remember why she was so angry with Annette, but somehow the logic of it had slipped her mind. The dancing had stopped, and Aaron had put down his pipes. All the villagers now gathered around the two women, mothers of the bridal couple.
Annette said, I was a foolish and selfish girl, and I made a stupid decision and lost the best man I've ever met. And you got him. Sometimes I can't resist the temptation to pretend it happened the other way around, and he's mine. So I smile at him, and I pat his arm. And he's kind to me, because he knows he broke my heart.
You broke your own heart, Gwenda said.
I did. And you were the lucky girl who benefited from my folly.
Gwenda was dumbfounded. She had never looked at Annette as a sad person. To her, Annette had always been a powerful, threatening figure, ever scheming to take Wulfric back. But that was never going to come to pass.
Annette said, I know it annoys you when Wulfric is nice to me. I'd like to say it won't happen again, but I know my own weakness.
Do you have to hate me for it? Don't let this spoil the joy of the wedding and of the grandchildren we both want. Instead of regarding me as your lifelong enemy, couldn't you think of me as a bad sister who sometimes misbehaves and makes you cross, but still has to be treated as one of the family?
She was right. Gwenda had always thought of Annette as a pretty face with an empty head, but on this occasion Annette was the wiser of the two, and Gwenda felt humbled.
I don't know, she said. Perhaps I could try.
Annette stepped forward and kissed Gwenda's cheek. Gwenda felt Annette's tears on her face.
Thank you, Annette said.
Gwenda hesitated, then put her arms around Annette's bony shoulders and hugged her. All around them the villagers clapped and cheered. A moment later, the music began again. Early in November, Philemon arranged a service of thanksgiving for the end of the plague. Archbishop Henri came with Canon Claude. So did Sir Gregory Longfellow. Gregory must have come to Kingsbridge to announce the king's choice of bishop, Merthyn thought. Formally, he would tell the monks that the king had nominated a certain person, and it would be up to the monks to elect that person or someone else. But in the end, the monks usually voted for whomever the king had chosen. Merthyn could read no message in Philemon's face, and he guessed that Gregory had not yet revealed the king's choice. The decision meant everything to Merthyn and Carys. If Claude got the job, their troubles were over. He was moderate and reasonable, but if Philemon became bishop, they faced more years of squabbling and lawsuits. Henri took the service, but Philemon preached the sermon. He thanked God for answering the prayers of Kingsbridge monks and sparing the town from the worst effects of the plague. He did not mention that the monks had fled to St. John in the Forest and left the townspeople to fend for themselves, nor that Carys and Merthyn had helped God to answer the monks' prayers by closing the town gates for 6 months. He made it sound as if he had saved Kingsbridge.
It makes my blood boil, Merthyn said to Carys, not troubling to keep his voice down. He's completely twisting the facts.
Relax, she said. God knows the truth, and so do the people. Philemon isn't fooling anyone. She was right, of course. After a battle, The soldiers on the winning side always thanked God, but all the same they knew the difference between good generals and bad. After the service, Merthyn, as alderman, was invited to dine at the prior's palace with the archbishop. He was seated next to Canon Claude. As soon as grace had been said, a general hubbub of conversation broke out, and Merthyn spoke to Claude in a low, urgent voice. "Does the archbishop know yet who the king has chosen as bishop?" Claude replied with an almost imperceptible nod. "Is it you?" Claude's headshake was equally minimal. "Philemon, then?" Again the tiny nod. Merthyn's heart sank. How could the king pick a fool and coward such as Philemon in preference to someone as competent and sensible as Claude? But he knew the answer. Philemon had played his cards well. "Has Gregory instructed the monks yet?" "No." Claude leaned closer. "He will probably tell Philemon informally tonight after supper, then speak to the monks in chapter tomorrow morning." "So we've got until the end of the day." "For what?" "To change his mind." "You won't do that." "I'm going to try." "You'll never succeed. Bear in mind that I'm desperate." Merthyn toyed with his food, eating little and fighting to keep his patience, until the archbishop rose from the table. Then he spoke to Gregory. "If you would walk with me in the cathedral, I would speak to you about something I feel sure will interest you deeply," he said, and Gregory nodded assent. They paced side by side up the nave, where Merthyn could be sure no one was lurking close enough to hear. He took a deep breath. What he was about to do was dangerous. He was going to try to bend the king to his will. If he failed, he could be charged with treason and executed. He said, "There have long been rumors that a document exists, somewhere in Kingsbridge, that the king would dearly love to destroy." Gregory was stone-faced, but he said, "Go on." That was as good as confirmation. This letter was in the possession of a knight who has recently died.
"Has he?"
said Gregory, startled. "You obviously know exactly what I'm talking about." Gregory answered like a lawyer. "Let us say, for the sake of argument, that I do. I would like to do the king the service of restoring that document to him, whatever it may be." He knew perfectly well what it was, but he could adopt a cautious pretense of ignorance as well as Gregory. "The king would be grateful," said Gregory. "How grateful?" "What did you have in mind?" "A bishop more in sympathy with the people of Kingsbridge than Philemon." Gregory looked hard at him. "Are you trying to blackmail the King of England?" Merthyn knew this was the point of danger. "We Kingsbridge folk are merchants and craftsmen," he said, trying to sound reasonable. "We buy, we sell, we make deals. I'm just trying to make a bargain with you. I want to sell you something, and I've told you my price. There's no blackmail, no coercion. I make no threats. If you don't want what I'm selling, that will be the end of the matter." They reached the altar. Gregory stared at the crucifix that surmounted it. Merthyn knew exactly what he was thinking. Should he have Merthyn arrested, taken to London, and tortured until he revealed the whereabouts of the document? Or would it be simpler and more convenient to the king just to nominate a different man as Bishop of Kingsbridge? There was a long silence. The cathedral was cold, and Merthyn pulled his cloak closer around him. At last, Gregory said, "Where is the document?" "Close by. I'll take you there."
"Very well."
"And our bargain? If the document is what you believe it to be, I will honour my side of the arrangement." "And make Canon Claude bishop."
"Yes." "Thank you,"
said Merthyn. "We'll need to walk a little way into the woods." They went side by side down the main street and across the bridge, their breath making clouds in the air. A wintry sun shone with little warmth as they walked into the forest. Merthyn found the way easily this time, having followed the same route only a few weeks earlier. He recognized the little spring, the big rock, and the boggy valley.
They came quickly to the clearing with the broad oak tree, and he went straight to the spot where he had dug up the scroll. He was dismayed to see that someone else had got here first. He had carefully smoothed the loose earth and covered it with leaves, but despite that, someone had found the hiding place. There was a hole a foot deep, and a pile of recently excavated earth beside it, and the hole was empty. He stared at the hole, appalled. "Oh, hell," he said. Gregory said, "I hope this isn't some kind of charade."
"Let me think," Merthyn snapped.
Gregory shut up. "Only two people knew about this," Merthyn said, thinking aloud. "I haven't told anyone, so Thomas must have. He was getting senile before he died. I think he spilled the beans." "But to whom?" "Thomas spent the last few months of his life at St. John in the Forest, and the monks were keeping everyone else out, so it must have been a monk. How many are there?"
20 or so.
"But not many would know enough about the background to understand the significance of an old man's mumblings about a buried letter."
"That's all very well, but where is it now?"
"I think I know," said Merthyn. "Give me one more chance."
"Very well."
They walked back to the town. As they crossed the bridge, the sun was setting over Leper Island. They went into the darkening cathedral, walked to the southwest tower, and climbed the narrow spiral staircase to the little room where the costumes for the mystery play were kept. Merthyn had not been here for 11 years, but dusty storerooms did not change much, especially in cathedrals, and this was the same. He found the loose stone in the wall and pulled it out. All Philemon's treasures were behind the stone, including the love note carved in wood, and there among them was a bag made of oiled wool. Merthyn opened the bag and drew from it a vellum scroll.
"I thought so," he said.
"Philemon got the secret out of Thomas when Thomas was losing his mind. No doubt Philemon was keeping the letter to be used as a bargaining counter if the decision on the bishopric went the wrong way, but now Merthyn could use it instead." He handed the scroll to Gregory. Gregory unrolled it. A look of awe came over his face as he read.
"Dear God," he said, "those rumors were true."
He rolled it up again. He had the look of a man who has found something he has been seeking for many years.
"Is it what you expected?" Merthyn said. "Oh, yes."
"And the king will be grateful?"
"Profoundly."
"So your part of the bargain will be kept," said Gregory. "You shall have Claude as your bishop."
"Thank God," said Merthyn.
8 days later, early in the morning, Caris was at the hospital, teaching Lola how to tie a bandage when Merthyn came in.
"I want to show you something," he said. "Come to the cathedral."
It was a bright, cold winter's day. Caris wrapped herself in a heavy red cloak. As they were crossing the bridge into the city, Merthyn stopped and pointed.
"The spire is finished," he said.
Caris looked up. She could see its shape through the spider web of flimsy scaffolding that still surrounded it. The spire was immensely tall and graceful. As her eye followed its upward taper, Caris had the feeling that it might go on forever. She said,
"And is it the tallest building in England?"
He smiled.
"Yes."
They walked up the main street and into the cathedral. Merthyn led the way up the staircase within the walls of the central tower. He was used to the climb, but Caris was panting by the time they emerged into the open air at the summit of the tower, on the walkway that ran around the base of the spire. Up here, the breeze was stiff and cold. They looked at the view while Caris caught her breath. All Kingsbridge was laid out to the north and west. The main streets, the industrial district, the river, and the island with the hospital. Smoke rose from 1,000 chimneys. Miniature people hurried through the streets, walking or riding or driving carts, carrying tool bags or baskets of produce or heavy sacks. Men and women and children, fat and thin, their clothing poor and worn or rich and heavy,
mostly brown and green, but with flashes of peacock blue and scarlet. The sight of them all made Caris marvel. Each individual had a different life, every one of them rich and complex, with dramas in the past and challenges in the future, happy memories and secret sorrows, and a crowd of friends and enemies and loved ones.
Ready? Merthyn said.
Caris nodded. He led her up the scaffolding. It was an insubstantial affair of ropes and branches, and it always made her nervous, though she did not like to say so. If Merthyn could climb it, so could she. The wind made the whole structure sway a little, and the skirts of Caris's robe flapped around her legs like the sails of a ship. The spire was as tall again as the tower, and the climb up the rope ladders was strenuous. They stopped halfway for a rest. "The spire is very plain," Merthyn said, not needing to catch his breath. "Just a roll moulding at the angles." Caris realized that other spires she had seen featured decorative crochets, bands of coloured stone or tile, and window-like recesses. The simplicity of Merthyn's design was what made it seem to go on forever. Merthyn pointed down.
"Hey! Look what's happening! I'd rather not look down. I think Philemon is leaving for Avignon."
She had to see that. She was standing on a broad platform of planks, but all the same she had to hold on tight with both hands to the upright pole to convince herself that she was not falling. She swallowed hard and directed her gaze down the perpendicular side of the tower to the ground below. It was worth the effort. A charrette drawn by two oxen was outside the prior's palace. An escort, consisting of a monk and a man-at-arms, both on horseback, waited patiently. Philemon stood beside the charrette while the monks of Kingsbridge came forward, one by one, and kissed his hand. When they had all done, Brother Syme handed him a black-and-white cat, and Caris recognized the descendant of Godwin's cat, Archbishop. Philemon climbed into the carriage, and the driver whipped the oxen. The vehicle lumbered slowly out of the gate and down the main street. Caris and Merthyn watched it cross the double bridge and disappear into the suburbs.
"Thank God he's gone," said Caris.
Merthyn looked up.
"Not much farther to the top," he said. "Soon you will be higher off the ground than any woman in England has ever stood."
He began to climb again. The wind grew stronger, but despite her anxiety, Caris felt exhilarated. This was Merthyn's dream, and he had made it come true. Every day, for hundreds of years, people for miles around would look at this spire and think how beautiful it was. They reached the top of the scaffolding and stood on the stage that encircled the peak of the spire. Caris tried to forget that there was no railing around the platform to stop them falling off. At the point of the spire was a cross. It had looked small from the ground, but now Caris saw that it was taller than she.
"There's always a cross at the top of a spire," Merthyn said. "That's conventional. Aside from that, practice varies. At Chartres, the cross bears an image of the sun. I've done something different."
Caris saw that, at the foot of the cross, Merthyn had placed a life-size stone angel. The kneeling figure was not gazing up at the cross, but out to the west, over the town. Looking more closely, Caris saw that the angel's features were not conventional. The small, round face was clearly female, and looked vaguely familiar, with neat features and short hair. Then she realized that the face was her own. She was amazed.
"Would they let you do that?" she said.
Merthyn nodded. "Half the town thinks you're an angel already."
"I'm not, though," she said.
"No," he said with the familiar grin that she loved so much. "But you're the closest they've seen." The wind blustered suddenly. Caris grabbed Merthyn. He held her tightly, standing confidently on spread feet. The gust died away as quickly as it had come. But Merthyn and Caris remained locked together, standing there at the top of the world for a long time afterwards.
This is John Lee. We hope you've enjoyed this production of World Without End by Ken Follett, published by arrangement with Dutton, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Text copyright 2007 by Ken Follett. Production copyright 2007, Penguin Audio, a division of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Books on Tape.